So I'm an old man now, and I rarely get nervous when I lecture someplace. But I confess to feeling some trepidation when Dalibor invited me to speak to Legatum Institute, including, as he did, kindly, a list of former speakers, all of whom were very distinguished economists. As will soon become apparent, I have absolutely no training in economics at all. Worse yet, much of my work has the unmitigated gall to challenge some fundamental assumptions that underlie game theory, decision theory, and much of modern economics. So I fear that in coming here today, I'd be a bit like Daniel in the lion's den, but without God's protection. On the other hand, it's often said that God looks out for fools and orphans, so though I'm not an orphan, perhaps I'll be protected after all. My aim today is to give you a very crude and brief tour of some of the issues explored in my recent book, Rethinking the Good, Moral Ideals, and the Nature of Practical Reasoning. Having spent nearly 27 years on the book, I'd like to say that this will be akin to taking a half-hour walking tour of the British Museum. But of course, it's probably more like taking a half-hour tour of your local dump. Still, as they say, one person's garbage is another person's treasure, so perhaps you will find some nuggets in what I present. Alas, in preparing today's talk, I soon realized that I'm guilty of a classic bait and switch for those of you who read the little presses that was distributed in advance. There simply isn't time to cover all of the topics I had originally hoped to, including, because of their complexity, some of those most directly relevant to economics. Moreover, even those topics I address will be only done so perfunctorily. But fortunately, we can explore any issues you're interested in, including the neglected ones, during the discussion. Part one, introduction. Over the years, I have canvassed literally thousands of audience members about a number of questions. One question goes like this. Suppose you're going to have to experience a certain intensity of pain for a certain duration. And I represent this, if I had a picture, the intensity of pain, that represents how intense it is. The higher it is, the more intense. A certain intensity for a certain duration, that's how long it is. Or are you going to have to experience a little less intense pain, so instead of, say, this big, it'll be this big, for a less twice, or three, or five times as long. So that's your question. You have to undergo one of these two pains, a certain intensity of pain for a certain duration, or a little bit less, but it's going to last twice, or three, or five times as long. And the question is, which would be better for you? Which would you want for yourself or your children? Now, if you reflect on this even a moment, it won't surprise you to learn, I think, that virtually everyone thinks it would be better to have the slightly more intense pain that lasts much less long. Indeed, well over 95% respond that way. And as I often like to put it, of the few who don't, some are just being difficult. Some figure it's a trick question, so they'll guess the wrong answer on purpose because then they'll be right. And the others simply haven't understood the question. A second question goes like this. Suppose you could live for a long time. Perhaps a very long time. Maybe I should emphasize that differently. Perhaps a very long time. And there are two ways your life might go. In one, you will have, on average, 15 mosquito bites a month. Came up with this example when I lived in Houston, Texas. There are mosquitoes everywhere. So 15 mosquito bites a month for the duration of your life. And in addition, at some point, we'll have 2 years of the most excruciating torture humanly imaginable. So whatever you've seen or thought of in the worst novel, the worst B-rate movie, whatever you've seen for torture, it's all of that. I mean, I'm talking about if you're eating lunch, so I'll be a little careful, but the wax under your eyelids, the bamboo shoots under your nails, the electrical shocks hooked up to your genitals. Imagine what I would be if you were eating lunch. For 2 straight years. Afterwards, you'll be given a pill so that you don't remember the pain. And it won't affect you in any other part of your life. But for those 2 years, it will be unendurable. Or there's an alternative. Instead, you have no torture of any kind. But Instead of 15 mosquito bites a month, you will have 16. And the question is, which would be better? Which would you want for yourself or a loved one? Now to this question, well over 90% agree. Most believe the life involving one extra mosquito bite per month would be much better, and they think this no matter how long the two lives might persist. Now, as noted, these results are very robust, but together, they're inconsistent. If one accepts the axiom of positivity, this is probably the only room I've ever lectured in where you don't have to say what that axiom is. I'm going to say it anyway, I'm going to remind you. If all things considered, A is better than B, and B is better than C, then A is better than C. Now, why are these two inconsistent? Well, it should be obvious, but I'll just remind you. I'm going to create a spectrum of alternatives. And on the spectrum, it's a bunch of different possible lives. All of the lives involve 15 mosquito bites per month. But the first member of the spectrum involves 2 years of the most excruciating torture humanly imaginable. The second member, 4 years of torture, almost as bad. The third member, 8 years, almost as bad as the four. The fourth member, 16 years, and so on. Remember when I asked you, would you rather have more intense pain for a certain duration or a little bit less for much longer? I didn't say how intense that was. And I didn't need to. Because everyone thinks it's a very robust result that will pretty much apply across the board. So we think, perhaps wrongly. But if that's the case, then the first outcome is better than the second. The second is better than the third. The third is better than the fourth, all the way down. If transitivity holds, the first has to be better than the second, the second is better than the third, the third is better than the fourth, the first has to be better than the last, but the first involves 2 years of the most excruciating torture humanly imaginable. The last just involves 16 mosquito bites a month. And hardly anybody outside of this room and a few of your peers believes that to be the case. So, the preceding reflects but one of many arguments that I used to claim give us a good reason to reject the axiom of transitivity. But my claim was misleading. In fact, what I've been doing is developing a series of possibility arguments, one of whose key premises is the axiom of transitivity. But of course, that's not the only premise in play. The second premise is a view I'll call the first standard view. Trade-offs between quality and quantity are sometimes desirable. On this view, in general, it's better to receive a more intense suffering for a shorter period of time than a less intense suffering for a longer period of time if the differences in intensity are sufficiently small and if the differences in duration are sufficiently large. A third premise is a view I'll call the second standard view. Trade-offs between quality and quantity are sometimes undesirable, even when vast numbers are at stake. On this view, in general, it would be worse to receive a more intense pain of a significant duration than a much less intense pain of virtually any duration, if the difference in pain intensity is such that the more intense pain significant duration would have a significant negative impact on one's life, while the less intense pain of longer duration would have little negative impact on one's life. The axiom of transitivity and the first and second standard views are powerfully appealing, and I believe that giving any of them up has deeply implausible implications. So my current position is a bit like that of a juggler who's juggling a number of very valuable balls, and I can't hang on to all of them. And I'm juggling them around, and I'm thinking, maybe I'll let transitivity fall. And I see it heading to the floor, and I say, that's way too valuable. I can't let that one fall. So I'll grab that quickly, and I'll throw it in the air. And as I do that, I see that the first standard view is heading towards the ground. I said, I can't give up that. I grab that, and I'm juggling, and I say, the second standard view, and I can't give that up. And I'm juggling and juggling and juggling. I can't keep them all in the air, but I don't know if I should give up. To a large extent, my book is about determining what various positions stand or fall together and illuminating both the benefits and costs associated with abandoning each of the premises in my impossibility arguments. Part two, some background. Many believe that giving up the axiom of transitivity is not an option. They believe that's analytically true, literally true by definition, that all things considered better than is a transitive relation. This is the view of John Groom, many of you know John, the current White's Chair of Moral Philosophy at Oxford, and at one time it was the view of three of the greatest living moral philosophers, Derek Parfit, Tom Nagel, and Tim Scannell. I suspect that many economists have held a similar view, believing that the transitivity of better than is an unquestionable and perhaps even self-evident axiom, which needs no argument. I think this view is mistaken, or more charitably, deeply misleading. Since people can use words as they wish, let me grant that there may be a use of the words, all things considered better than, for which the axiom of transitivity is true by definition. We could call this, if we want, John Broome's use of the word. But then let me hasten to add that, as the philosopher Wittgenstein might have put it, meaning is use. And there's another widely accepted usage of all things considered better than, what I will call the reason involving sense of better than, according to which to say that A is better than B, all things considered, is to say that from an impartial perspective, there's most reason to rank A as more desirable than B, taking full account of all of the factors that are relevant and significant for making that comparison. So if A is better than B in terms of all of the factors that are relevant and significant for making that comparison, we think that A is better than B, all things considered. I call that the reason involving sense of betterment. And as I shall suggest shortly, on that notion, a widely accepted one, even if it is true that better than is transitive, it is not an analytic truth. It's a substantive normative truth, if it's true. Part three, the internal aspects view versus the essentially comparative view. I want to tell you what I think is actually going on in this domain in a very short time. I believe that there's two radically different conceptions of moral ideals, which I'll call the internal aspects view and the essentially comparative view. And I believe both views are enormously plausible. Both have a tremendous grip on our way of thinking about the world. But it will turn out that not only one of these views would better than be a transitive relation. The other, it would not. Okay, so a word about the internal aspects view. The internal aspects view roughly says the following. How good or bad an alternative is depends solely on the internal features of that outcome. So if this is A, and this is B, and this is C, how good A is a function of what's going on in A. Do you care about equality, justice, utility, maximum, whatever it is? You look at A, you say, how good is A with respect to equality, justice, utility, maximum? And depending on how good that is, it will tell you how good A is. And that just depends on what's going on in A. Call that the internal aspects. For simplicity, the easiest way to understand this picture is you think that you could assign a number representing how good A is on a real number line that expresses or reflects the degree of value that the internal features of A have when they combine. Make it 103 for A. On this view, then, how good B is depends solely on its internal features. Let's just pretend it's a 97. And again, how good C is depends solely on its internal features. Let's pretend it's an 83. Now, if the internal aspects view is correct, and it's very powerful, and it seems like it's got to be right, then indeed, as you can imagine, all things considered better than will be a transitive relation. Because if based solely on its internal features, A gets a higher score than B, and based solely on its internal features, B gets a higher score than C, then the score that C will get in comparison with A will be the same as it got when compared with B, because it's just based on solely internal features. If this is higher than this, which is higher than this, this will be higher than this, not surprisingly. surprisingly than gesundheit. All things considered bad then will be a transitive relation. And other features that are really cool and nifty that we like to have in economics and philosophy will also hold. As you can tell, the independence of our own alternatives principle would hold on this conception. Because obviously, to know how A compares with B, we won't need to know how either of them compare with respect to C, D, E, or anything else. Because how those other things score doesn't matter at all. All that matters is what's going on in A and what's going on in B, and that will determine how A compares with B independently of anything else. Other wonderful principles would hold, like a principle I call the principle of like comparability of equivalence, which is given on the last page of the handbook. The problem is that despite its enormous appeal, the internal aspects view doesn't reflect the thinking that many of us engage in when we actually assess the goodness or badness of outcomes. Many of the ideals that people value most, including the Pareto principle, the narrow person affecting view, and some particularly plausible versions of a maximin-like principle or utility, have an essentially comparative structure. And these views, there is no fact of the matter about how good or bad an outcome is dependent solely on its internal features. Rather, how good it is will depend on the alternative with which it's compared. Or, to put it slightly more precisely, I don't really have time today for these qualifications, but slightly more precisely, there may be a fact of the matter about how good or bad an outcome is, considered just by itself, but that will have no special privilege relative to an assessment of how good or bad it is in comparison with other alternatives. On this view, different factors can be relevant and significant for assessing different outcomes, depending on the alternative with which they're compared. But, and this is the key point, if that is the case, then there's no reason to expect transitivity to obtain. Because after all, if it could be the case that in assessing A, the factors that are relevant and significant for assessing A vary depending on whether you're comparing A with B or A with C, which is what the essentially comparative view tells you, then there's no reason to expect transitivity to hold, because it could be that A is better than B in terms of all of the factors that are relevant and significant for making that comparison. And B is better than C in terms of all of the factors that are relevant and significant for making that comparison. But A may not be better than C in terms of all of the factors that are relevant and significant for making that comparison, if the factors that are relevant for making that comparison might be different from those for comparing A with B and B with C. So on an essentially comparative view, there's no reason. So the key question in this domain is whether the nature and structure of ideals reflects the internal aspects view or the essentially comparative view. And this, I really strongly urge, is not determined by the meanings of the words, all things considered better than. This is not an analytic issue. This is an issue about knowledge of truth. If moral ideals have the structure of the internal aspects view, then indeed the axiom of transitivity will hold. But if they have the structure of the essentially comparative view, as might be the case, then it will not. Now, a quick look at what was going on with the very first example. When we looked at the first standard view, we compared how does A compare to B, we were invoking the first standard view. What we were basically adopting was roughly an additive aggregationist approach. When I compare A with B, I basically take the quantity times the quality of the pain and suffering, and I multiply them out. I do an additive aggregationist thing. I measure the area under the curve, and I say A is better than B. And I use that same approach for comparing B and C, and C and D, and E, all the way down. But when I compared A with Z, I wasn't doing an additive aggregationist approach, and neither were you, if you were thinking like almost every normal human being. You weren't just adding up the total area under the curve. The total area under the curve would be larger with all those mosquito bites than with the 2 years of torture. But we were adopting an anti-additive aggregations approach. We were thinking for that comparison, you don't just add up the sum total. But then the factors that are relevant and significant for assessing A vary depending on whether we compare A with B, in which case we adopt an additive aggregations approach, or A with Z, in which case we adopt an anti-additive aggregations approach. And then there's no reason to expect transitivity to hold for the reasons I've given. Now, of course, some totally utilitarians, many economists, would simply reject anti-additive aggregations reasoning. They would just insist that as long as there are enough extra mosquito bites, the life including all those mosquito bites is worse than the one with 2 years of excruciating torture. But is such a view really plausible? Would any of us actually choose such a view for ourselves or our children? If we were being clear thinking and rational, here are three related cases where most people would oppose simple additive aggregation. Most people firmly believe that Derek Parfit's repugnant conclusion is indeed repugnant. I'll tell you what that is. They believe that an outcome A with at least 10 billion people, so you have a huge number of people, all of whom are enormously well off, would be better than an outcome Z with a vast population, all of whom have lives that are barely worth living, no matter how many people live in Z. So God's going to create one of two universes. In one, there's 10 billion people and they all flourish. In the other, there's zillions and zillions of people and they all have lives barely worth living. If they stubbed their toe one more time over the course of their lives, it would have been better for them if they'd never been born. Parfit finds it very repugnant to think Z would be better than A. Similarly, most firmly believe that an incredibly flourishing human life, McTaggart actually gave us this example more than 100 years ago. They believe that an incredibly flourishing human life that lasted, say, 1 million years would be better for the liver of that life than a mere oyster-like existence. No matter how many years one might live in oyster-like state, I'd assume that oyster-like existence has a tiny bit of momentary pleasure at each of its moments. But the other life, for 1 million years, has everything that you think is valuable. Mozart-like life, Beethoven-like life, Einstein, whatever it is you think it matters. And likewise, most firmly believe that no matter how many people would each get one lick of the lollipop, it would be better for that not to occur if it unavoidably involved an innocent person suffering unbearable agony for a long time and then dying. Cover of my book, which I only show because it was drawn by my daughter. Lollipop for Life example, if you ever look at that, you'll remember that was drawn by Tunja's daughter. Notoriously, total utilitarians reject such claims. Insisting that more utility is better than less utility, they offer a number of sophisticated explanations, and there's lots, for why our intuitions about such cases are not to be trusted. For the total utilitarian, then, no matter how small the amount of good may be in a life that is barely worth living, or in a moment of oyster-like existence, or how small the amount of pleasure might be, from one lick of a lollipop. If only there are enough such lives, moments, or licks, eventually the total amount of good or pleasure will be greater and then be better than any finite amount of good or pain that might be balanced off against it. Now, the utilitarian's position is admirably consistent, but it reminds one of Emerson's contention that, roughly, consistency is the hobgoblin of philosophers and people with little minds. Where I've always thought that what Emerson meant by that was that consistency is the hobgoblin of philosophers, colon, people with little minds. Few are willing to bite the utilitarian's bullet in such cases, and I believe they're right not to do so. in evaluating outcomes, we don't simply care about how much utility obtains. We also care about how that utility is distributed and the impact that that distribution has on people's lives. Part four, neutrality and dominance principles. The common assumption is that in certain contexts, for example, where no special relations or obligations are involved, morality requires us to be neutral with respect to people, places, and times. I have serious doubts as to whether space and time should be treated the same, which I'd love to go into, but don't have time for right now, but maybe in questions if you want to ask me about. But suppose for a moment that we go along with this neutrality assumption. Most people also would accept dominance principles of the following sort. If A is better than B at every point in space, notice this is a really weak Frege-like principle. It doesn't just say better at one point in space and equally as good as ever. I'm actually saying better at every point in space. Then all things considered, A must be better than B. Or if A is better than B at every point in time, then A must be better than B. Or if A is better than B for every person who will ever live, then A must be better than B. How could those not be true? It just seems obvious that they must be true. But then consider the case represented in diagram one. In diagram one, we have two alternative worlds, W1 and W2. And it works like this. Excuse me. In W1, on day one, there's one person in existence, and that person is in hell. Hell is a really bad place, by the way. In day two, that one person in hell has moved to heaven, but two new people have been created in hell. In day three, all three people are in heaven, but six new people are created in hell. In day four, all nine people are in heaven, but 18 new people have been created in hell, and so on. It keeps going like that for eternity. In W2, the exact reverse holds. One person is in heaven on day one. That person moves to hell on day two, but two new people are in heaven. All three of those people move to hell on day three, but six new people are in heaven. On day four, all nine people are in hell, but 18 new people are in heaven, etc. Now the question is, which of these two worlds would be better? Well, if you look at it moment by moment, it's pretty obvious which would be better, W2. Why not? After all, on day one, it's one person in hell versus one person in hell. One person in heaven, sorry, versus one person in hell. Well, W2 wins on day one. What about day two? On day two, there's two people in heaven or one person in hell versus two people in hell or one person in heaven. Day two seems better. What about day three? Well, it's six people in heaven, three people in hell, or six people in hell, three people in heaven. W2 again seems better. So at every single moment in time, it seems clear that W2 is better than W1. But is it? Look at the impact not by time, but by people. If you look at it by people, in W1, each person spends exactly one day in hell and the rest of eternity in heaven. In W2, each person spends exactly one day in heaven and the rest of eternity in hell. Here we seem to have a very simple, short proof that we have to give up at least one of the dominance principles. And I know how I would choose. In assessing these outcomes, I ultimately want to pay attention not merely to the impersonal question of how much well-being there is in the two outcomes, but to the question of how the distribution of the well-being affects the people in those outcomes. Hugely different focus. Part five, essentially comparative ideals. I suggested earlier that some ideals people value have an essentially comparative structure, including the Pareto principle, the most plausible version of the maximum utility, and the narrow person-affecting principle. Given my time constraints, let me focus on the latter, reserving comments on the Pareto principle, for those of you who are interested, I think many of you might be, for discussion. In assessing outcomes, many people appeal to what I call a narrow person-affecting view. This holds roughly that one should, one, focus on the status of independently existing people, those who will exist no matter what choice one makes, with the aim of wanting them to be as well off as possible. And two, ignore the status of dependently existing, those whose existence depends on one's choices, except that one wants to avoid harming them as much as possible. Regarding clause two, a dependently existing person is harmed only if there's an available alternative outcome in which that very same person exists and is better off. Now, there are lots of ways the view needs to be qualified. We can get into that during discussion when you all start pressing me on this view. But it reflects a view that's widely accepted in many cases. For example, consider three possible policies for an initial population of, say, 10 billion people. In policy A, the people can have, those who want to have children, one or two children. It's up to them. But either way, both the parents and the children will be at a very high level. Let's just call it level of 1,000. In policy B, those who want to have children will have four children each. And there'll be all sorts of benefits from this. And everyone, the parents and all the children, will be at level 1,200. In policy C, everyone who wants to have children will have eight children. There will be some benefits from this, but some costs as well. And all will be at level 800. Now, many people believe that in A, the first outcome, the first policy, the parents can choose to have one child or two. It's up to them, and it doesn't matter. Either outcome would be equally good. They believe that, although the total utility would be greater if everyone had two children rather than one among those having children, as long as there's enough people already existing and sufficiently well off. It doesn't make the outcome better merely to add lots more people who have lives worth living. Similarly, many believe that policy B would be better than A, because it would be better for the independently existing people to be at level 1,200 rather than at level 1,000. And likewise, many would believe that policy C would be the worst policy, because it would be worse for the independently existing people. Now, they think this, even though C might have the most total utility. Still, it involves a world where everyone's at level 800, rather than a world where everyone's at level 1,000 or 1,200. For many, their judgments about policies like A, B, and C reflect their acceptance of a narrow person-affecting view, which I have claimed as an essentially comparative structure. So if we accept such a view, and it has that structure, then for the reasons I've said, we can't expect transcendence as a whole. Could we abandon the narrow person-affecting view and simply adopt impartial views or wide person-affecting views? Yes, of course we could. But not without abandoning a view that many care deeply about. Not without abandoning a view that many people actually employ in their reasoning a lot. And not easily. Consider diagram four. I'm purposely leaving myself open to attack with these examples, but that's okay. I'll respond later. I'm using examples involving infinity. Some of you will think that's a cheat. I have examples involving, not involving infinity. I just like the ones involving infinity. I'm sorry. I'll give some of the non-infinity ones during quick Q&A if you have one. But I love this example. Consider two worlds, W3 and W4. Each T represents a time period, 1,000 years, say. Could be whatever you want. Each S represents a place in space. You can call it a planet if you want. And the way it's set up is as follows. As you can see, in W3, there's one person at level -1 at time one and space one. One person at negative two, at time two and space two, one person at negative three, at time three and space three, etc. All the negative numbers are lives below the level at which life ceases to be worth living. All of these people would rationally kill themselves if they could, if they weren't Catholic anyway. Anyway, so the thought is that their lives, they'd rather be dead. W4 is like W3, except that at T1 and S1, a person's at negative 11 rather than negative 1. At T2 and S2, a person is at negative 12 instead of negative 2, a person is at negative 13 instead of negative 3, etc., etc. If God were to create either W3 or W4 and we were just looking at these worlds, well, there's a number of things you might say. On an impersonal or wide person objective view, one might think that W3 and W4 are equally good. I won't try to tell you why one might think that, but one might. Or one might try to claim that they're on a par. Or, on the view I actually favor, one might hold the obviously sane view that W3 is better than W4. That's on an impersonal view. But suppose I tell you the following story, a piece of information I hadn't told you before. Everybody who lives and exists in W4 also is going to live and exist in W3, the very same people. In the following way. The person who would exist at T1 in W4 exists at T21 in W3. So instead of being at negative 11, that person's at negative 21. The person who would have been at negative 12 in W4 is at negative 22 in W3. The person who would have been at negative 13 is at negative 23 in W3, and so on and so forth. In other words, every single person who lives in W4 also exists in W3 and is much worse off. And in addition, there's an extra 20 people who don't exist in W4, all of whom live in hell. All of whom would be better off if they never existed. Now, if I give you that information and I ask you how do W3 and W4 compare, now I think, as do most people who hear this story, think it's clear that in that situation, W3 is clearly and unequivocally worse than W4. And we hold that for narrow person-affecting grounds. We're not just paying attention to the impersonal question of how much utility obtains in the world. We're asking the question of how are the particular people affected for better or worse in those worlds. And when we hear the backstory of how they're affected for better or worse, we now come to a judgment about W3 and W4 that we think is correct and that we couldn't get to on a wholly impersonal way. Finally, consider diagram 5. Ooh, okay, really incoming. Oh, we start. Consider diagram 5. Last thing. W5, you look at it, you have three worlds, W1, W2, W3, and you can see in each of them there's a person at negative 1, negative 2, negative 3, etc. How do they compare? It looks like they're all the same. It looks like W1 is equal to W2, W1 is equal to W3, and W2 is equal to W3. And if there are different people in all these worlds, that would seem like the right judgment on impersonal and wide person-affecting grounds. But now let's suppose that while the people in W1 are different than those in W2 and W3, there's overlap between the people in W2 and W3. In particular, let's suppose that the relationship between W3 and W2 is just like the one I gave you a moment ago between W4 and the other W3. Sorry about that. Should relabel these. So the person would be at negative 1 and W3 is at negative 11. I'll make it the same. Yeah, negative 11 here. Person at negative 2 and W3 is at negative 12 and W2, etc., etc., etc. Now, there's very good reason to think that W2 is indeed worse than W3. Everybody who exists in W3 exists in W2 and is much worse off. And in addition, there's 10 more people who have lives that are not worth living. Now, here I want to say, if the people in W1 really are different than the people in W2 and W3, then there's still very good reason to hold that W1 is equal to W2. and W1 is equal to W3. If equally, by as equal, I mean equally as good as. If equally as good as is a transitive relation, it would follow that W2 would have to be equally as good as W3, but we don't believe that. W2 is clearly worse. And here we need to appeal to something like the narrow person-affected view to account for our views about how the different alternatives compare. And it should be clear, these have an essentially comparative structure. Here we can't say how good W3 is based solely on its internal features. How good it is depends on the alternative with which it's compared. Different factors are relevant significant for making different comparisons. That explains why the transitivity of equally as good as does not hold. The point is that there's a factor that's relevant and significant for comparing W3 to W2 that doesn't come into play for comparing W3 with W1 or W2 with W1. And that explains why equally as good as is not a transitive relation. Part 6, concluding remark. Let me end with just one final remark. My book raises a lot of problems. In fact, it's filled with impossibility theorems, though I don't formalize them. Alas, even after all these years of working on these topics, I have no real sense of where to go from here. I wish it were otherwise.